Welcome to the New Books Network.
Thinkers on the far right have in recent years appropriated the language of liberal democracy, but with the aim of superseding it. They've grown influential in certain circles. Are they a threat to democracy? Should we be worried about them? Welcome to International Horizons, a podcast of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies that brings scholarly and diplomatic expertise to bear on our understanding of a wide range of international issues. My name is John Torpy, and I'm director of the Ralph Bunche Institute at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Today, we discuss the role of far-right thinkers in the contemporary political landscape with Jim McAdams of the University of Notre Dame. A. James McAdams, his full name, is the William M. Scholl Professor of International Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. For 16 years, he was director of the Nanavik Institute for European Studies there. He's written widely on European affairs, especially on Central Europe, as well as on global communism. His books include Germany Divided, Judging the Past in Unified Germany, and Vanguard of the Revolution, The Global Idea of the Communist Party, published by Princeton University Press, at first in 2017. And that book was named by Foreign Affairs as one of the best books of 2018. He's recently published a volume on contemporary far-right thinkers and the future of liberal democracy, and will soon publish an edited volume, Far-Right Newspeak and the Future of Liberal Democracy, with the political theorist Sam Piccolo of Gustavus Adolphus College. Thanks for being with us today, Jim McAdams.
My pleasure.
Great to have you. So you're about to publish this book on far-right newspeak and the future of liberal democracy. It seems to me certainly very much like a continuation of the work that you did in the previous book on contemporary far-right thinkers. Can you tell us what you mean by far-right newspeak and who uses it?
Sure thing. First of all, the book is out, and I have it right here on my desk, so it's available to everybody. The difference between the two books is that in the first, we were shining a light on major contemporary far-right intellectuals, who some of whom weren't known or some of whom weren't understood well, and we tried to compare them in a systematic way. This is the follow-up to that project, in that we're focusing on a substantive theme, which is the use and abuse of the language of liberalism and democracy in such a way that it's propagators may undermine or hollow out liberal democracy. Far-right newspeak, well, it is a reference to George Orwell, but with a twist. What's interesting, if you compare our use of newspeak, far-right newspeak, and Orwell's, is that Orwell was concerned about the replacement of the old speak language of liberalism and democracy and those values with a new speak emphasis on dictatorial values. In contrast, the people we're talking about are using the language that Orwell was so determined to defend. They're using the language of liberalism and democracy in ways that all of our contributors believe represent a serious threat.
Okay. And I note that, the book is coming out in a series that has the term fascism in it. And I have to say, I'm always kind of uncertain about the use of that term and what it means. I mean, I tend to be a purist of some sort who, thinks of fascism as a particular kind of unique historical event coming out of particular circumstances, the First World War, and the clash basically of communism and fascism. So I wonder if you could talk about, you know, to what extent you see this contemporary far right newspeak as coming out of a similar kind of contest, or is it a backlash against what's going on the left? I'd be interested in how you see the context.
John, we completely agree about the nature of fascism. The full title of the series is Fascism and the Far Right. Like you, I understand fascism, or at least most of its manifestations, to be historically specific, particular to the period of the 1920s to the 1940s, which is not to say that there weren't fascist parties afterwards, but that we're talking about something very different. And in fact, anybody who looks at the thinkers that we cover in this book will find that, at least in our view, none of them should be legitimately called fascist. And just to give you and others a sense of how I look at this historically, and both of us are historically minded social scientists, fascism emerged at a time when liberal democracy was not well established at all, in which it was weak, and in which the defenders of liberal democratic ideas, values, institutions were incapable of finding the support they needed to maintain their fledgling regimes, particularly in places like, of course, Germany. The circumstance is very different today, and this is why it's so important not to fall into the temptation of describing these thinkers. Now, there are other people that one could talk about and legitimately call fascists, but the people that we cover are, after all, the people who have grown up in societies in which liberal democracy is well established. It's not, at least until recently, it has not been threatened in the way it currently is. And so, at least for the people we cover, it's important to emphasize that they are part of the world after World War II. Now, what's also interesting to recognize here, and I consider very important, is the fact that certainly there were fascist parties after World War II. One can still find them. There were extremists of that ilk. And, these people were around, are around. They use words like democratic. But until recently, they could not reach audiences. Whereas the people we're calling far right, and it's a tricky term, but the people we're calling far right are notable because they have reached very broad audiences using this language, the language of liberalism and democracy. And importantly, those audiences are mainstream. And that's where we see a very different threat. Mainstream audiences who vote, mainstream audiences who would normally never throw their support to people that, in fact, are racist, people who are propagate as hateful or politics based upon hatred. Normally, these audiences wouldn't support them. So a good way of thinking about the contrast is, if you think about somebody like Alexander Dugin, for example, There, it's clear. There are many traits of Dugin's thinking that are easy to call fascist. And in fact, Dugin argues that his goal is to create a truly fascist, as if it weren't realized before. But he's very different from the people we look at, people like Marine Le Pen, like Tucker Carlson, like Jordan Peterson, like Peter Thiel. These people are not appropriately called fascists, I think.
Right. Well, I'm glad you mentioned Tucker Carlson, because I know, you know, we're both interested in Europe, and Alexander Dugin is familiar certainly to people who pay attention to Russia, but maybe not so well known here. But, you know, maybe you could talk about a little bit about Tucker Carlson and his, you know, his use of this newspeak, and, you know, who is he appealing to successfully, and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's a great contrast with Dugin, because, you know, Dugin interests intellectuals, but otherwise people don't listen to him at all. Hundreds of millions of people are interested in Tucker Carlson. He has tremendous weight in American politics. He uses fascist tropes on occasion, like the Great Replacement theory. He deliberately and consciously interviews fascists, like Curtis Yarvin, whom he does not tell his audience that these people endorse slavery, for example. But Tucker Carlson is primarily a person and an opportunist who uses the language of liberalism to reach audiences who are, for a variety of reasons, aggrieved. So Tucker Carlson will say, I'm completely for equality, and I believe that everybody should be equal in the United States. Everybody should have equal rights. And it's fine that we're paying attention to people of color and other minorities to guarantee that they have equal rights. But then Tucker Carlson will say, well, but because I believe in equality, what about white rights? What about white people? Aren't majorities equally, shouldn't they equally be guaranteed the right to equality? And it's a fascinating position, because it is essentially subversive. Because what Carlson does not talk about is the fact that the people in the majority have the power. And they have the ability to define agendas that people without power do not have. And that's why we have programs like Affirmative Action, for example, which Carlson has certainly criticized. All diversity and inclusion programs, he certainly criticized. But again, let's get back to the idea of the appeal. So when Tucker Carlson says to his audience, don't white people have rights too? Shouldn't everybody be treated equally? What he's doing is he's tapping into a constellation of liberal values, and all of the contradictions within those values in a way that appeals to mainstream audiences. Because one can imagine many Caucasians who are unemployed or underemployed or having a job, hard time getting the job that they feel they deserve. One can immediately imagine these people saying, well, yeah, I have the right to equality too. So why are all these other people being treated equally and I'm not? And that's Tucker Carlson's power, but it is a language, again, far-right newspeak, a concept that Sam and I have coined, far-right newspeak. It is a way of using liberal language to undermine the values that undergird liberal democracy.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I've been struck by, and that you address a little bit, at least in the introduction to the book, is, you know, goes beyond these issues of newspeak, to, I mean, Tucker Carlson is following in many ways Viktor Orban, or at least many people have, you know, made that argument. Carlson's made a pilgrimage to Budapest, et cetera, et cetera. So, but one of the ways in which a lot of this seems to me to be playing out is a kind of global culture war. I mean, you talk about, you know, those who kind of defend or promote traditional values, you know, the return of the church, the, you know, the promotion of the family, those kinds of ideas, as against, you know, what, say, somebody like Dugin sees as the, you know, the destruction, really, in a way, of the human personality that is a product of liberal individualism, right?
Yes.
And so I wonder, you know, whether you could talk a little bit about that. And is that a correct kind of diagnosis, or for whom is that a correct diagnosis?
Well, I think it's a correct diagnosis. Certainly that's the case. I think it's important to emphasize, when we're talking about people like Carlson and Orban, is that these people are opportunists. And their goal, you know, in Orban's case is to maintain and increase his power. In Tucker Carlson's case, it is to massage his ego and to make tremendous amounts of money. And so it's not so much that we have a cultural war in which both sides have declared war on each other, as it is a case in which policies have been implemented based upon values to address historical injustices. And people like Carlson and Orban have swooped in to go to war, in effect, with these positions. And they're very, very effective as opportunists. But I think there's a lot of shallowness to their claims. After all, you know, nobody on the left is saying, well, we're opposed to families. Nobody on the left is saying we're opposed to traditional values or to all traditional values. So it's more the right that's declared war on the left. And I think grotesquely exaggerated the issues. I mean, if you take affirmative action, for example, the right portrays it as this massive injustice inflicted upon white people, and that's just not the case. It is simply an attempt to address historical injustices. So the opportunism is huge here. And Orban's very interesting and quite cynical. Orban talks a lot about the importance of the family and you know, traditional values. And so he's attracted a lot of fans in the West. But at the same time, Hungary has very liberal abortion laws. And Orban certainly is in the position, has the power to go out and change the laws. He's a great manipulator of the courts and the constitution, but he doesn't talk about it.
Right. Well, these people are not always consistent, let's put it that way.
No, they're not. And
as you say, for cynical reasons, perhaps. But
yes, the people that we focus on, not maybe all of them, but almost all of them are quite cynical. Although, you know, this is a scholarly publication, and our articles are written by scholars. And I think it's important to emphasize that we take everybody we read, and we read everything. I've read enormous amounts of George Jordan Peterson's work. I've read his books, which is an ordeal. I've listened to his videos. I've done the same thing with Tucker Carlson. There's one chapter in the book, in which one of our colleagues examines the feminist perspectives of Marine Le Pen, so this is scholarship. We're not out to indict anybody or condemn anybody. We're simply interested in how does their manipulation of language affect liberal democracy, and does it threaten liberal democratic norms and institutions? And in one way or another, we're all convinced that it does.
Yeah, clearly the book is concerned about, you know, our future, and you know, it's self-consciously a kind of defense or an attempt to promote the defense of liberal democracy. And one of the things that you get into, at least in a sort of limited sort of way, is the question of violence. And it seems to me, you know, historically, fascism obviously had a lot to do with violence, the use of political violence. So I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about, you know, your assessment of what's going on, you know, particularly in the United States, but, you know, problems of political violence have been cropping up elsewhere, not least in Germany. So I wonder, you know, how, I think this is a question you ask in the book, how worried should we be?
I think we should be very worried about the future of liberal democracy, and I'll say something about that in a minute. But most of the people that are covered in our book couldn't be accurately described as advocating violence. It would be more appropriate to say that they are laying the ground, the ideational grounds, if you will, for people who are very much interested in committing violence. And so what we're talking about here is a recrafting of the language of liberalism and democracy in such a way that it can be tapped into for just about any systemic attacks on the system that one can imagine. And, you know, it goes without saying that Donald Trump is much taken by this language. He argues that he's the real Democrat and Joe Biden isn't, or the real defender of democracy. But of course, Donald Trump has clearly played a major role in inciting violence with his language, and also nowadays pretty much laying the grounds for its legitimation. So if you look at the way that January 6th is now described by him and many Republicans, it's as if it were some noble patriots who simply walked into the Capitol and, you know, in good patriotic fashion, defended American democracy by standing up to a vote on an illegitimate election. So we can see there how the language can spill over in ways that make liberal democracy, that weaken liberal democracy and potentially threaten it. And you and I know, as historically minded sociologists, that there's no guarantee that liberal democracy will be with us forever. In fact, historically speaking, we know it won't be. So the question now is simply, how long does it last? What kind of staying power does it have? And, you know, in our book, one of the major themes that we emphasize is that institutions are not enough, that democratic institutions need to be infused with liberal values and liberal attitudes, or they can be easily undermined.
I mean, I guess, let me try this on you, since we've raised the Trump issue. It seems to me that what Donald Trump has done above all is to assert a kind of notion of, you know, homo economicus is the only kind of human being that really is around, that everybody basically has an angle and there's no sense of, you know, the greater good or the common good, that those are for suckers and losers. And what he's done is to destabilize people's belief in these institutions, which I certainly agree with you are, you know, crucial to maintaining this way of life called liberal democracy. About that, and how common is that, or not common to, I mean, in some ways, I think it's unlikely to be very common to various European populations, at least, that, you know, this is not something most people, not the way most people would think about the world, but in the United States, he's succeeded in destabilizing people's belief in a common,
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, it is the case that in my view, and from my experience traveling to Europe regularly, things are in fact much worse here in the United States than in Europe, which is not to say that everything's great in Europe, because it's not. I think what you're describing, the case of Trump, is cynical manipulation of public institutions to serve, you know, his private purposes. It's cynicism and opportunism. And the other thing that I'd add here is simply that, you know, it isn't simply one individual or a group of particularly dangerous individuals, but it also reflects what has happened with liberal democratic institutions in recent years. So if parties, if politicians are bought out because it's the only opportunity, money is the only opportunity that they have to get reelected, then they're easily manipulable. And we see this particularly now. I have my concerns about the left, but I think particularly now on the right that, you know, cynicism has been turned into a virtue. And many people, many Republicans who would under normal circumstances in this country be much more moderate, much more reasonable, feel that they have no choice but to take the stands that they do. And so, amidst this climate of cynicism, we can see why this why far right newspeak worked today and couldn't have worked in the past. I mean, if you took a far right extremist, you know, people like David Duke in the past, and he used this language, everybody would still say he's a racist. But today, if you use language which is in fact racist, millions of people say, well, that's not racist at all. That language is about equality. It's about defending fundamental liberties. And so we're going to vote for it. And so here you see this kind of, incestuous relationship developing between the desire to gain and maintain political power on the one hand, and the corruption and abuse of language.
Well, thanks for that uplifting conclusion.
I tell my students it's also important to be hopeful.
Yes.
We live in a world in which it's easy to falsify false optimism. Mm-hmm. And it's easy, you know, to be pessimistic because mm-hmm. after all things end. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if we emphasize hope, then we can motivate people, particularly the younger students that you mm-hmm. and I teach, to go out and defend our values and our
right.
system.
And I think the book is helpful in understanding the ways in which the path, as I think you said, you know, is plowed towards, you know, real problems down the road. So thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Great
I want to
pleasure.
Thank Jim McAdams. I want to thank Jim McAdams for sharing his insights about far-right newspeak and the contemporary political landscape. I want to thank Osvaldo Mena Aguilar for his technical assistance and to acknowledge Duncan McKay for sharing his song International Horizons as the theme music for the show. This is John Torpy saying thanks for joining us. We look forward to having you with us for the next episode of International Horizons.